The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Okay, here we are. It's Friday, and it's time to talk to a man who has really come into his own in the last, 8 or 9 months on this program. He is a remarkable individual in terms of being a true historian, a researcher, a writer, a man who has pushed it to the red line most of his life and continues to do that right now. We could call this the next chapter in the life and times of Harry Cooper. He is the man, of course, who most recently brought out the book Hitler in Argentina, shattering really forever the lie about what happened to Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun in World War II, where they went, as did maybe tens of thousands of other Germans, and that was primarily to Argentina. Harry has been down there. He has found the processing center, the plastic surgery center where needed. He has found all kinds of things that were there and are still there, and has shown pictures of them on this program. They are in the book Hitler in Argentina, and a DVD is on its way, so you'll get to see things in real-time video as well. How are you, H.C.?
I'm hanging in there. How are you, Jeff? Always
I'm
good
okay.
to be back on your show.
Thank you. Thank you. It's kind of like coming home here.
Yeah, you betcha.
We have a lot to talk about tonight, and I think primarily we should just bring folks up to date on what's happened since this awesome book burst upon the scene. Now this it merits me saying that this book that Harry brought out, Hitler in Argentina, of course, was preceded by his earlier book, Escape from the Bunker, which was just despicably stolen from, plagiarized by other phonies, and now Harry has trumped them all, and that's great, and we're very happy about that. There's more coming out, and there's a new book on the way. So once the door was opened with Hitler in Argentina, things began to appear, and that's what we're going to talk about, among other things, as well tonight.
Right.
So where are you on this, in this whole thing? How fast is it moving? I know you like speed, but this is probably pushing you to the max as well.
Yeah, well, Hitler in Argentina includes the earlier book, Escape from the Bunker. The entire Escape from the Bunker is embodied in Hitler in Argentina. We
sure.
added about 170 pages.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, we've put in files that we got from the FBI that now these files are on the Internet. Anybody can see them, but it was one of our agents, a guy we called Tauker, who got them all found and declassified about 4, 5, 6 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and now they're there for anybody to use. And there's anybody who thinks Hitler still died in the bunker in 1945 is just fooling themselves, because the FBI knew he was gone to Argentina, the CIA knew it, Stalin knew it, and half of the upper echelons of both the Soviet and the Allied military, they all knew it. And as you know, when we're down there in Argentina, and I'd be interviewing people who actually had knowledge, they just wondered why we were going to all that trouble, because they all knew Hitler lived down there.
It's common knowledge.
Yeah, and Bormann and Eva Braun and a lot of others that we point out in the book. Fridolin Guth, who controlled the purse strings for Die Spinne, otherwise known as Odessa.
Mm-hmm.
And Fridolin Guth was the SS officer who started a bakery and restaurant down there. It was Ludwig Freude. He was the guy from the Banco Transatlantico Alemán, the German transatlantic bank. He controlled the purse strings. Scorzini was down there. Rudel, one of the great, probably the greatest pilot ever. He down there, along with General Adolf Galland and Werner Baumbach. They helped reform the Argentine Air Force, turned it into a really professional Air Force. So, you know, the Third Reich did not evaporate at the end of the war. They just moved. And whether you call it still the advanced Third Reich or the new Fourth Reich, whatever your handle you want to put on it, mm-hmm. it's still operating today. We know, I know a lot of the people in it. We can't get into that in depth, but we
no need. No need.
Yeah. Dead end topic there.
Yeah, for sure. I understand. Okay. Now, the book sales have been terrific. We keep putting them out. You keep sending them out. They have attracted the attention of a couple of filmmakers who want you to sign away your life and your grandchildren's lives and all the rest of it, which is typical. These legal contracts, the longer they are, the more treacherous they are. And
well, you fortunately, we have one of our members. We've got thousands of members in 76 countries. One of our members is a really top-notch attorney. He's a partner in a large law firm in Washington, D.C. He teaches law at Northwestern University, and I believe he's up for a federal judgeship. So, yeah, this was a company that wants to translate the book into French and sell it worldwide in French. The contract they sent me, of course, like you said, they wanted my children and my children's children, but I passed it to our attorney. He lined out what needed to be lined out. He added in what we needed added in, and bingo, they're happy with it. So now we've signed the contract, and I sent them, within 2 days, I'll be sending them the PDF file, and they'll translate it into French, and they will have the worldwide exclusive rights to publish this book in French. That's all they got. They wanted the worldwide exclusive.
No, they always had. They asked for the moon.
I know.
Always do.
And didn't want to pay any royalty worth squat, but we reworked it, and I was really surprised they took our reworked contract and said, yep, we'll go for it. So we now have also a German publisher that we're going to meet with shortly. And I know this one will come off fine because, first off, this publisher is a friend of a good friend of mine over there in Austria. And also when you're dealing with the Germans, you really don't have to look to see what the other motives are. You don't have to worry about another shoe dropping because
They're still up front. They still have that ethic. Wow.
Straight up and honest and honorable right out of the gate.
Yeah.
So, and then somebody else suggested we have it done in Spanish, which I agree, but we need a translator.
And what did you talk to Adrian?
I haven't heard.
Okay, keep writing him.
Okay.
He wants to do it. So
he'll
line you up with someone who will do it, and you'll have a Spanish version copy, and it can go all over the southern part of this hemisphere, no problem at all.
Yeah, and all over the Spanish-speaking part of
Europe
as well.
Yep. Yeah. No, so, Adrian will do it. He's very busy, but just keep e-writing him. He made it clear on the air he wants to see the book in Spanish, and he offered to help, so he'll do it.
Well, we don't mind that. And any help anybody can give, God bless them.
Yeah.
So,
now,
you mentioned how this book is selling. My administrative assistant told me earlier today we have to place an order with the publisher for another 100 books here because we're out of stock almost.
Great.
That's great. And it's not only great that, but the biggest single thing is we're presenting the honest history, whereas it wasn't being presented before.
Correct. Yeah. Now, when it gets published, we'll go through this, Todd. If it gets published in Germany, when it gets published in Germany, I wonder, I don't think that the Zionists would have an axe to grind with it to the extent that they could shut it down. And it will say, it will become a bestseller in Germany. It will go to the top of the charts. I can almost guarantee it. No, listen, it's a done deal. Now, the German translation is where? How are we doing with that?
Well, we've just got the door open to meet with this German publisher.
Uh-huh.
And that's as far as we've gotten with that. I was supposed to be going over there next month,
mm-hmm.
but I have to meet with a couple of our angels, as we call them.
The yes, people, understood. Yeah,
great guys that'll write a check to keep this.
These are unsung heroes, and I want to personally thank them on behalf of millions of people who want the truth. You,
right.
you angels are making this possible. Harry, of course, is the man, but without you, he's got no gas in his tank.
That's it.
Keep him fueled up, and he will continue to knock down walls that were otherwise impregnable. I can't wait to see this in Germany. And anywhere along the line, Harry, if you run into publishers or producers or anybody who will be further enhanced, shall we say, if you were to invite them on this program with you, do it. Problem at all. None. Say
super.
We'll introduce you to the American mm-hmm. audience and explain why you want the book and et cetera. So use this program as if it were your own.
Well, that's awful decent, Jeff. You've been an incredible help to Shark Hunters and to this book from the get-go. And, boy, we sure appreciate it.
My honor. Believe
me. And you got us introduced to Dave Dees, who did the cover art. Boy, what an incredible cover that guy did for us.
Yeah, I had a little hand in that, but he did a great job. He really did.
Now, incidentally, you would think that once the book was out, Hitler in Argentina, you would think, boy, that's everything in there that you could ever want to know about Hitler in Argentina. And at mm-hmm. the point of time when we published the book, that was it. But now, since the book came out in March, which is the republished version,
uh-huh.
with all the stuff we learned down in Argentina up to and including just this past January, my agents down there in Argentina, they're coming up with more and more and more. You've seen some of the stuff that I sent you for the last couple of shows.
Yeah.
The old lodge, which is now crumbling, where Perón went to ski school when he was a young officer in the army, and mm-hmm. in the late 30s, he used to go there to meet with the German agents. And that boy was a busy fellow, Perón. Boy, talk about feathering your nest. He sure did do all the right things.
He burned the midnight oil.
Yeah, he did. And he liked the young dollies, too. He married Evita, mm-hmm. who was a hooker. And then later, after she died, he married Isabelita, who was 35 years younger than him, and she was a table dancer. You fill in the blanks on that one. Now, I've tracked down Isabelita. She's still alive. She's, I think, 82 years old now. And I've written to her a couple times, uh-huh. explaining who I am and that I would like to come and visit with her, but I think she's of the opinion that yesterday's gone, and I don't want to hear about it anymore.
Did she meet with the two principals when they were down there, do you think?
I don't know. I can't get anything out of her. But you remember, we did publish that one photo of her, and it's in the book,
mm-hmm.
where she's standing there with her right arm stretched out in the mm-hmm. so-called Nazi salute. And this was in 1974,
uh-huh.
30 years after the war ended.
Well, there's a fairly good chance that she may have. I hope that she comes around. Just tell her you're not in any... I'm sure you have, but these people need to be put at complete ease. You're not in any way trying to exploit her. In fact,
right.
you can tell her that we won't use your real name. We just want the experience and the information.
Well, that's
use
it. We got to have the information.
Yeah.
And we now, we're close to getting agreement from that one laborer, his first name was Hernan. Don't remember his last name. It's in my office. But He's the one who saw Hitler speaking to Ante Pavlik.
Three different times
down there at Mar del Plata.
Mm-hmm.
And Ante Pavlik was the Croatian strongman who finally escaped to Argentina.
Mm-hmm.
Started out as a bricklayer, and then through friends he met Juan Perón, and suddenly he owned a big construction company that pays to have friends in high places.
Yeah, well, Juan married some interesting women. As the old Red Fox joke goes, Eva Perón was in more laps than a napkin. And
she was a hooker, more or less.
Yeah.
And she was kind of a pass around with all the other colonels.
Mm-hmm.
And then she was, if nothing else, she was a very sharp cookie. And she saw that Perón was going to rise above everybody else, so she latched on to Perón. But, was she faithful to him after that? Who knows? There's rumors. We haven't nailed them down yet, but there's rumors that she was banging Otto Scorzini when he came over to Argentina.
Well, that wouldn't surprise me.
Well, she was a beautiful woman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Sad she died so young. It's sad when anybody dies young, but
yeah,
just the way things are, I guess.
It happens.
Yeah.
It happens. Cancer is not a selective machine.
No,
it
pretty nasty
after
stuff.
People.
So, and she refused treatment, which I don't understand. But of course, we're talking, how many years ago? Was it 1952? I think she died somewhere around there.
65 years ago,
that,
almost.
Yeah, she, they didn't have the medical advances they have now.
Mm-hmm.
Thank God they have them now. As I think a year ago, December of 2012, we had to do rush cancer surgery on my wife. Thank God they got it all out. They couldn't have done that back in the day of Eva Perón.
There are many different cures for cancer, natural cures that work.
Yeah.
It's not the cut, slash, and burn stuff is really middle-aged. If you want, anything you need, let me know. I have access to it. That carnivora.com product is not to be ignored. That should be a daily regimen for anyone who has cancer. It actually ought to be a daily regimen, period, just to keep your immune system up. Everybody gets cancer every day, and the body defeats it. It's that simple. When you run the body down by eating processed food and crap and junk and live a lifestyle that is not healthy, your immune system can't handle the cancer and it establishes a very strong beachhead, and then you got a problem. So.
Yeah, unfortunately, we do have all this processed food and hormone-injected stuff over here. When I go to Germany or when I go to Argentina, I eat like there's no tomorrow, and yet I lose weight.
The food's wholesome, of course.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
It's not injected with growth hormone.
Well, you got herbicides, pesticides, they're eating GMO crap here. There's so many more things that they are exposed to. And I want to tell you another thing. Meat over here, especially beef, is eating grass and other additives, and they are at the top of the food chain. So when you look at Fukushima and the radiation, which starts out low, this is all bioaccumulative, upscale. By the time you get to the top mammal consumers of lower animals and foods that have been exposed to this, you got a real problem. And that's something we didn't have to face 4 years ago. We got to face that now. So,
as I told my VA doctor, who is absolutely aghast, I tell her, I eat from the four major food groups, cookies, candies, cake, and ice cream.
Isn't that the way it is?
Yeah, if my wife's gone somewhere else and I need lunch real quick, I'll just grab the ice cream out of the fridge and eat ice cream with chocolate sauce, or I'll eat cupcakes or something like that. Very healthy stuff, but
it's all right.
Knock on wood, thank God.
You got the constitution for it, and somehow you're able to handle it.
That's the Irish in me.
Yeah. Well, very good. Okay. So, tell me about the DVD. This is going to be very interesting. Are you going to show in the DVD scenes of what is down there in Argentina, pictures and video and stuff? Is that
you
what we're hoping for?
Oh, great. You were the one who originally beat me up. You hammered on me, make a DVD, make a DVD. You got to have a DVD. And one of our new member, Robert Miles, and his fiance Leslie, they have a production company. And I guess it was sheer coincidence. They approached me and said, hey, look, we do DVDs like that. And I said, okay, well, Jeff's been beating me up to get it done. So I said, okay, let's do it. And they flew me out to their production studio. They had a suite reserved for me in the hotel, and the living room was set up like a film studio. There were umbrella lights and cameras and backshots and backdrops and all this stuff. And we filmed from about 1 o'clock until about 6 o'clock one day, then the next day from 9 until noon.
Oh, yeah.
And it was going to be a project they'd get done tomorrow or the next month or the month after that. And then all of a sudden, after he looked at all the film he took, he sent me an email and said, okay, this is our number one priority. We're going to have it done quick. So we sent them a bunch of the photos that we took and a bunch of World War II footage that they're going to splice in. And it's going to be a really nice nice DVD. And I'll let you know as soon as it's done. And, of course, we'll send you a copy.
Well, thank you.
If
they need any narration, let me know. I'll be happy to do that. So this is very, very encouraging. You're going to call it Hitler in Argentina, the DVD?
I suspect, because they're going to use the cover art from the book for the DVD case.
Excellent.
So
very good.
Yeah.
All right.
You know, the doors have opened, and a lot of people have reviewed this on the Internet. Everybody has given it, you know, top marks, 5 stars, except one fellow said it read a little, it was a little bumpy as he read it, but it gave it 4 stars. But then there were two guys who were negative. One guy who didn't use his name, so we'll call him No Stones Jones.
Yeah, that works.
Yeah. Very short. He said that while the book is correct, Cooper is a neo-Nazi who wears a swastika ring, so don't give him any of your money.
Oh, please. Well, so, sounds like a tribe member.
I have no idea, but I'm not a Nazi, neo or otherwise. I don't even own a ring with a swastika on it. And if we sell 10 million books, not a damn dime of it comes to me. It all goes to shark hunters. I don't even take a salary because I'm an old guy, and I've got my retirement. And I do shark hunters 12 hours a day because I gave my word to all the great veterans who helped me along in the early stages, because I gave them my word I would keep their history honest. So just because I got old is no reason to just turn mother's picture to the wall and shut everything down. I still work 12 hours a day. I've been at my desk since 3 o'clock this morning like normal.
That's the truth, folks. Let me tell you, I'm often up till 3, and Harry starts writing me when he's gone to work, and that's pretty funny.
Yeah. Well, normally I'm in bed looking at the inside of my eyelids by this time at night, but so we're adding this to my overtime pay, and so that's time and a half for zero. I can't figure it out. I never get a paycheck.
All right, we got to take a break here. Hold on, we're running a little late here. Let me do this and we'll come right back, Harry.
Go for it.
Back with Harry Cooper in just a moment. Don't go away. Okay, back with Harry and all of you good folks, and I hope you've all gotten your copies of Hitler in Argentina. Let's get this done and start spreading the word about the truth, about the end of World War II and what happened afterward. No more BS concocted by those who would seek to drive us all down the wrong road and fleece us during the journey, because that's what they're doing. It's just wrong. All right, what else? And then we'll jump into our pictures here.
Okay. Don't forget to let your listeners know they can read all about the book on the website, sharkhunters.com. And if your listeners would like a free copy of our magazine, we publish a monthly magazine electronically, And they can just send an email to sharkhunters@earthlink.net and just say they heard us on the Rents Radio and they would like a copy of the magazine. Bingo, bingo, it comes right back to
them. It's
no
a real
obligation.
Treat. Yeah, I hope you folks do it.
Yeah, well, you get the magazine.
It's great.
It's a pretty good magazine.
That's superb. Yeah.
Of course, I'm kind of prejudiced. I like it.
Well, you've done a marvelous job putting it together and creating it, and your staff is as good as it gets.
And they're all volunteers, too.
They are. They're great people. I know who they are. Wonderful. Okay, if you want to go to guests@rents.com, click on photos under Harry Cooper's name. We'll load those up and take a look, and we're going to have some fun here, I can see already by looking at these in the beginning. That you were an amazing athlete. That is an athletic skill that very few have. That's the total coordination of hand, eye, mind, and you almost have to be psychic too and be able to read what's going to happen or how other people are going to do things. I mean, I'll bet there are things that come into play that most people could never understand. And that is a very high-speed stock car race driver, Harry Cooper. He was one of the best.
Well, it was a lot of fun, let me tell you. I started out on the short track, mostly O'Hare Stadium outside Chicago.
Looks like it was packed.
Yeah.
People
loved
it.
It was a big deal there. A lot of big names. Ed Rathman, who won Indy many years ago. Freddie Lorenzen, who was later was a champion in NASCAR. He started there, and I got the nickname of Dirty Harry long before anybody ever saw the movie with Clint Eastwood in it. We had an unwritten rule there at the track that if a slower car didn't get out of your way, you just nudged him on the bumper a little bit and let him know you were there. And
really?
Then if he didn't get out of your way, then you moved him. Well, I figure if he can't watch his mirror if he's going slow, I just move him.
Well, that's how your door got dented.
Yeah. And every other part of the car, after a while, you know, you get tired of replacing body parts there. If you had a straight car, God help the guy who came out his first time with a straight car. A lot of guys would go out of their way to bend it up for him. Not me. I was just running for the front. But,
I get it. Yeah. Yeah.
But as you say, on the big track, on the super speedways where you're running 190 miles an hour and you're 2 inches from another car, you have to anticipate because there's no time to react. You have to anticipate. Otherwise, either they go past you or if there's a problem going on up track, then you're part of it before you're into it.
Yeah,
190 miles an hour.
Toast.
Things go by in a hurry.
Yeah. Now, that's you always had number 17. Looks
yeah,
like.
There was a reason for that. I started out drag racing. And
now, that had to be a kick.
It was
those big dragsters in the 50s and 60s.
Well, I didn't run a dragster. I ran a car and a stock class, but it was fun.
Uh-huh.
And your car never got bent up, and it always looked impressive as you're towing out to the drag strip.
Oh, yeah.
But your race lasted a handful of seconds, and I'm thinking, wait, there's something more to this. And the guy that kind of so-called sponsored me, he owned a Sunoco station, he sponsored me in that I got free gasoline for the race car, not for the pool car.
Uh-huh.
He had, as a matter of fact, that old number 17 there that you see, photo 1 and 2, that had been his car. And I used to think a stock car was nothing but an old junk with a few miles left in it. And one night he called me. He was at the track. He needed a timing light, so I ran up there to give him the timing light. And wow, the ground was shaking. These cars had some awesome engines in them, and then I got to see a stock car was not just an old junk with a few miles left in it, but a very well-designed and well-built car. Sometimes you get dented up.
Sure.
So I bought the car from him, and he and I had a falling out. And I decided I would leave at number 17 because he had been a mediocre driver. And my first night out at the track, 1966, I had never driven a circle track before, and my qualifying time was 1/10 of a second faster than the best he had ever posted in 4 years that he owned the car.
Whoops.
Yeah, so I won quite a few races, and in 1968, the last year that O'Hare Stadium was in operation, I wound up being second in the points chase. I probably would have, I like to think I would have won the championship, except I blew an engine 6 weeks before the end of the season, and I didn't have any money, and so we raced Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So if you lose 6 weeks, that's 18.
3 days, really? Three days a week?
Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Oh, yeah, that was big around Chicago. But those tracks are all closed now. O'Hare Stadium was sold in 1968.
Mm-hmm.
The last race was Labor Day, and within a few months, there was no more track. It was bulldozed down, and they built a high-rise office building there. And when I was a kid, my folks used to take me to Soldier Field, where Andy Granatelli promoted the stock car races there, and there was 87th Street Speedway, and there were quite a few stock car tracks in the late 50s, early 60s. But unfortunately, the property was worth a whole lot more, so it got sold to build a high-rise apartment.
Oh, that's what happens.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I don't live in Chicago anymore, haven't for a long time, so I don't know if there's any, if the sport is as popular as it once was. They still had the Raceway Park down in Blue Island, Illinois, and they also had Waukegan Speedway. I don't know if they're still operating. I haven't even been back to Chicago for a good 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, you pick Chicago up like a sponge and got as much out of it as you can. More power to you. That's great. All right, we'll be right back in a couple. Hang on with Mr. Harry. Okay, we are back. Talking to Harry. And again, let me remind you, go to sharkhunters.com and get the book Hitler in Argentina, Hitler and Eva in Argentina. Read the truth. Read the real story. No more BS. It's time to shake out all the liars and frauds and phonies. This is the ultimate book, and there'll be more coming out soon. So before we go back to the pictures, Harry, what's coming up? You got another book coming. What's going to be in it?
Well, that's going to be the one we have. We have a book out right now called The Secret Alliance, which explains how Germany and Argentina were very closely aligned from the beginning of the 20th century. And all the doors were basically open for the mass exodus at the end of World War II. Well, a lot came down at the end of World War One. Admiral Canaris, who was only Oberleutnant, Dursey Canaris, mm-hmm. back mm-hmm. in 1915,
mm-hmm.
he found the little town of San Carlos de Bariloche at the foothills of the Andes, and, you know, typical Germans, they kept perfect records on everything. And
when did he find it, Harry, approximately? When did he first go down there, do you know?
Oh, okay. Well, he was on the cruiser Dresden during the Battle of the Falkland Islands, which was 1915, and Admiral Graf von Spee got his whole cruiser squadron blown to shreds except for the Dresden. It was one knot faster than the British cruisers, and so it got away. It went through the Magellan Straits around towards Chile, and as they were going through the Straits of Magellan, Canaris was finding all these little hidden coves and hidden harbors where warships could hide, and they called them U-plates, which is short for unbekannt plates,
mm-hmm.
unknown place. And he was making charts and diagrams. And in 1938, the old line ship Schleswig-Holstein came back and followed and got even more definitive information about these places. And we have charts of all of them, and we've reproduced a few of the charts in the book, Hitler in Argentina. But now when, in 1915, when the Dresden got around to one of the major ports in Chile, she was pretty well finished. Her engines were shot, and she was not much more than a floating junkyard. The crew was interned, and Canaris either escaped or bought his way out, one or the other, and he went by horseback over the Andes into Argentina. And when he came down the eastern slope of the Andes, there was this little town called San Carlos de Bariloche on the shore of this huge big lake, and he thought it was a great place. Then in 1944, when it was pretty obvious Germany was going to be on the wrong side of that war, they were going to lose, they had a skipper by the name of Garbers, Heinrich Garbers.
Okay.
And you see his picture, and he's wearing the Knight's Cross, excuse me, which usually means heavy combat, sinking a lot of ships, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But Garbers, you can't find Garbers any place in the history. Well, Garbers was the skipper of a 90-ton sailing vessel called KFK 202, sometimes called Kylo, sometimes called Mary. He had been running in and out of ports in Argentina all through the war.
Mm-hmm.
And he was asked by either Arthur Axman or Martin Bormann at a party in 1944, could he get in there if he had special guests on board? And Garbers told him, yeah, not a problem. And a little while later, Gross Admiral Dönitz was heard to say that they had found a Shangri-La for the Führer, and we figure it means Bariloche. Bariloche, when we got off the plane in 2008, the first time I went there, you'd swear you were in a Bavarian village at the foothill of the Alps.
The architecture, I guess, was all German and Bavarian down there, or most of it.
Yeah, it looked just like a Bavarian village, and there's photos of that on the website.
Yeah.
Go to sharkhunters.com and then click on previous tours. There's also explanations of that in the book, Hitler in Argentina. And so when the war ended, that's where they sent Hitler and Eva Braun. And we've seen pictures of Rudel, like I say, the greatest pilot probably ever, and Otto Skorzeny, the number one commando from Hitler's group. They're out there skiing in the Andes. Well, why not ski in the Bavarian Alps, which is where they live? They came over here to ski in the Andes. Well, he came over here to visit with Hitler in Bariloche. And Skorzeny was also over to move some money around from Bormann to put it into use with what they call Die Spinne, the spider, which otherwise known as Odessa, which incidentally is functioning still today. So that's how they picked San Carlos de Bariloche.
Well, it turned out to be the place where the Mercedes family built a beautiful home, which we have color pictures of. Harry's been there. You can find that at sharkhunters.com. It's also in the book. In fact, it's on the front cover of the book.
Right.
And so many more things. It's all there. And
yeah.
Hitler and Eva lived there for 10 years.
Right, until 1955, when the area was discovered as a
tourism.
Vacation place,
tourist
area, because of the big, beautiful lake for the fishing in the summertime and in the winter for the skiing. So they moved up to Cordoba province, and eventually Hitler died in Mendoza province. But we're getting down the road a little ways. I'm going back in January. I'll be up in Mendoza, assuming I've got a meeting with each one of my two angels individually in July. I'm going to try to convince them to shake loose another handful of money to go down there, excuse me, I'm going to need 4 weeks this time because we're finding a lot more in Uruguay. That's where that big Junkers Ju-390 landed. They only had one in operation at the end of the war. They only built three.
Yep.
And it landed on a 15-kilometer-long straight stretch of highway. They had put a radio homing beacon in a little clump of woods nearby, and this plane landed. And it had some people on board, but we don't yet think anybody of great importance. But it had the so-called Nazi bell, Die Glock, which I'm still trying to figure out what that thing was about. But they had interior cylinders counter-rotating, I think.
Well, they call it anti-gravity, but whatever it was, it's...
Right. Some people feel it, it bends time.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it is, I just got an email this morning from one of the world's top researchers on the bell, who's also a member of Shark Hunters, and he said that the bell is still in the possession of Die Spinne in Argentina.
Oh, they have it.
Yeah, that's what he said.
And the big Junkers was cut up and thrown in the river, you think?
It was cut up almost immediately after it landed, and you know, you cut it into small pieces. But what do you do with the engines and stuff? So my theory is that the engines got dumped into the river. So I'll be going down there again to that location, finding some old people that were there, and maybe my metal detector. I should put in a plug for White's metal detectors, because they sent me a metal detector comp and said, here, go find some history with it.
Good job. Thank you, White's. Thank you very much.
Yep. So, there, plus Paraguay, we knew there was a lot to do with Paraguay, but now we're finding names and places.
Mm-hmm.
So once you got names and places, you can go take pictures and sit down and talk to people who were there at the time.
Well, you can take video with your smartphone. Easy.
I went out and bought a new video camera.
Yeah.
Which is wonderful, except, you know, to a computer dummy like me, all your video comes up on a chip. And what the hell is this? How do you work that? Where's the tape go? Well, there ain't no tape. The camera's about the size of a pack of cigarettes.
Yeah, yeah.
So... And for clandestine filming, I have a pair of sunglasses that has a camera and a chip built in. So,
really?
Oh, yeah.
Kind of like Google Glass, I guess.
Yeah. I've also got a ballpoint pen that sits in my pocket that if you push a button, it's recording too. Video.
Secret stuff here.
Yeah.
Well, good.
Just like James Bond, eh?
You're wired... Ready to go. All right, well, this is exciting, and I hope that if Die Glock is still there, can you imagine? Also, somewhere, I believe, that Hitler and Eva are buried together at some location. I don't think they would have desecrated their remains and thrown them to the seven winds, frankly.
I had this discussion with... George Knapp when I was on Coast to Coast, and I told him I didn't know where...
You wouldn't say if you did. No way.
That's right, and I also said I wouldn't want to know, and he popped up real quick. He said, well, I'd want to know. I said, really? You realize that if you really knew where they were buried, the Neos be wanting to find out where he was so they could make a shrine.
Correct.
And other people would be wanting to know so they could dig him up and
tear it apart.
Him.
Yep.
And I said, if you refused to talk, you'd find burning bamboo splints underneath your fingernails.
Yep.
And if you told one group, the other group would be out to kill you. I said, so I don't want to stick myself in that mess. Oh. I've lived a lot of years on this earth, and I'm really enjoying it. I got a lot of years left to go, and I don't want to wind up getting shot.
Nope, and that's not an exaggeration either. Very smart.
No.
Okay, we got to pause here again, Harry. Hang on, we'll take our top of the hour break and come back and rejoin our pictures. The fascinating life and times of Harry Cooper and the story, the real story of what happened at the end of World War II to Eva Braun Adolf Hitler, and maybe tens of thousands of Germans who were all taken, some of them, by American DC-4 long-range four-engine transports from Europe to the Canaries to Argentina. And I have a line on one of the pilots who's still alive. He's 90-something years old. I'm trying to get hold of him to see if he'll come on the program or at least talk to Harry off the record. So we'll see. All right, back in a minute. Hang on. Okay, sounds like the somber march of history throughout the decades and centuries. Talking about history that still is extremely relevant today, because what we see in Europe is very much a result of what happened in World War II. I mean, absolutely. So I can guarantee you, had Germany won the war, you would not see Europe being overrun with illegal immigrants and aliens from sub-Saharan Africa, from the Muslim Middle East. They're doing the same thing to the EU as is being done to the United States. There would have been a united Europe under Germany. There's no question about that. It would have been run properly, however, not the way these Brussels lunatics are running it, with the Rothschild banksters actually owning it. So we got a whole different side of the coin to look at. Okay, let's get back to the pictures with Harry Cooper as we get caught up to date on what's going on. All right, we're looking at the race car pictures. We got Texas 500.
Into the work I'm doing now. Photo 3 and 4, they were taken at Michigan International Speedway. And photo 4, that yellow car behind mine, that was Pancho Carter, who also used to run Indy cars. And Pancho was fairly young, like I was. I was in my early 30s. And we used to try to steal each other's groupies. And poor Pancho, I always won. I'd usually go home with my groupies and his groupies. I was single back then. Then photo 5, that's me in 17 passing the number 19 car. We're doing about 190 miles an hour there. And the engine in my race car blew. I was a much better driver than I was an engine builder. And going home to Chicago, the engine in my truck blew. I got back to Chicago. I was an executive with a company there, and I found out my boss had quit, and I got a new boss who was a real jerk, so I just sold everything, bought a 30-foot sailing yacht you see in photo number 7. Mm-hmm. It came as a kit. You know, it was like building a boat model.
Really?
1-to-1 scale, yeah. Huh. And most people, if they even got the thing done, it took them 3 years. It took me from the time the hull rolled in to the time the boat was launched was 2.5 months.
Wow.
And
wow.
I advertised for female crew slash companion for a trip to the islands. I got over 200 replies. Yeah, and wrote back to each one. There was no email in those days.
Yeah.
Sent a picture of me, sent a picture of the boat, and described the tour. And I said, there's two things that are absolute. One, if you do drugs, don't bother answering this letter. Two, if you think you're going to sleep alone, don't bother answering this letter.
Nothing like a little honesty, yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah, you got to lay your cards face up on the table.
Yep.
So I got over 150 replies back, so I whittled it down. I left Chicago with a blonde, a brunette, and a redhead that were 24, 24, and 25 years old, and I was 40, and went to the island. Aside from the obvious, the greatest part about that was there's no stress. Stress kills you. And in photo number 8, we're just cruising into the islands in the northern Exuma chain. And when
where's the close-up picture of the crew, Harry?
I didn't get too many of those, but I got a black and white of the front page of the local newspaper. I think it was in the Chicago Sun-Times way back many years ago. They were all beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
So we got down to the southern Exumas. That's a chain in the Bahamas. And there was an island there that was circular, which is rare. Most islands in the Bahamas are long and skinny.
Uh-huh.
And on the west side, usually you can walk for miles without getting your armpits wet. And on the east side, 2 feet out, you got Mother Ocean, goes down to maybe a mile deep. And this island had been a plantation during the war years. And the old caretaker told me that they had supplied fresh water and food to some German U-boats. Now, whether they did or did not, we never proved or disproved. But I remember my first thought was, those dirty Nazis, because Germans were all Nazis. That's what we were taught. They
were the worst of the worst. Monsters on 2 feet. Yep.
Yeah, machine gun people in the water for sport. But the remains of the barracks building and the Radio Shack were still there, all overgrown. The ruins of a mansion were there. Okay, well, I tucked it into the back of my head because I had other more important things, Lynette, Karen, and Debbie.
You had to take care of the crew. Captain. I got
it. And one by one, they went back because you can't live vacation your whole life. And as the last one went back, one or two others had come out, et cetera. And I lived for about 8 years on my boat in the island. And it was a wonderful life because, like I say, there was absolutely no pressure, no stress. And stress kills you.
Yeah.
And finally, one day, I reached into my wallet. I had $5 left to my name. So sailed back to the Florida Keys, put my boat into a marina there, hitchhiked home, mooched a room from my sister, and went back to work. And I started to research, and I find that this was all, this was all wartime propaganda. It was not true. They were not raving anything. They were very proud, patriotic young men. They were not so-called Nazis because in the German Navy, they were not allowed to belong to any political party, which is what the NSDAP was, which we called Nazis. Their belt buckle says, Gott mit uns, God is with us. And they didn't machine gun people in the water. And they had the worst attrition rate of any military force ever in history.
Yeah. Ever.
As a comparison, the United States Navy Submarine Service, these were tough guys, too. They were... And AAA brass balls, as they used to say about the race car drivers, they had the worst attrition rate of any military in the United States military during World War II. One man out of seven got killed. Which
one
is
out of seven?
Rate. One man out of seven got killed.
That's a very high attrition rate.
And on the German side, it was reversed. One man out of seven came home.
That's astounding.
That's suicidal.
Yeah.
And you cannot maintain those kind of losses in a combat situation. And so I thought, first off, all the propaganda was necessary during the wartime because you got to hate the enemy. Otherwise, nobody wants to kill anybody. Maybe there's something to be said for changing that. But these guys, they didn't desert. They didn't run for it. They just sent their personal belongings home to mother and went out. Toward the end of the war, from Black May onward of 43, one out of every 10 German U-boats came home from its first patrol. First patrol, 9 out of 10 got sunk on their first patrol.
Unbelievable.
But they still kept going.
never ran out of volunteer.
No, it was oversubscribed at the end of the war. And then I met a couple like Herbert Werner, the guy that wrote Iron Coffins, which was a great book. And then Carl Friedrich Merton, who was one of the top skippers, won the Knight's Cross with Oak Leaf. And after a while, and Reinhard Hardhagen, who sank the first ship in American waters, after a while they realized that I was not a so-called Nazi hunter. I was not looking to make a ton of money at this.
Sure.
They opened the door. And before long, I met Otto Kretschmer. He and I became good friends. He was the top submarine commander of the war. I had a sleeping room in his house in Emden. And the youngest combat submarine commander, Hans-Georg Hess, 21-year-old kid. They gave him command of a submarine and told him, go on out and die. He came back from 5 war patrols, sank some ships, got his Knight's Cross. He and I became best buddies. He was an attorney. He was a 21-year-old kid. They gave him command of a submarine. God bless.
Hard to believe.
So,
what must have knocked you over was this is beyond patriotism, what these men were doing. They were going out to die.
Yeah.
But they were fighting for principles.
Yep.
They weren't fighting for the National Socialist Party. They weren't allowed to belong, as you said, and in the entire German military, less than 10% ever belonged to the party. That's
right.
The truth. And
Navy, the German Navy, Kriegsmarine, they were absolutely forbidden.
Yeah. Well, you must have been just blown away by with the reality, and all of a sudden, the big lie became clear. Huge lie.
Oh, yeah, you realize all the good guys really weren't all that good. Some were, some weren't. All the bad guys really weren't. Eric Topf, the guy who sank the first American warship, which he, by mistake, this was a month and a half before the U.S. was in the war. It was a stormy Halloween night. 1941, he was up off of Iceland, and here's this British convoy going by, and he sees these four stacked destroyers escorting the convoy, and he figured they were some of the 50 that we had given to the Brits, and he fired, and he hit the USS Reuben James, and he didn't even know it was an American ship until the other American ships were calling SOS saying that it was USS Reuben James, and these Germans had such an incredible sense of honor. It bothered him all the way up until his death. I knew Topf real well, that he had attacked a ship of a navy with whom they were not officially at war.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
well, that's honor and integrity. That's the biggest secret I think in history about the war, is the general overall caliber of ethics employed by the German military in the war. Incomparable. Nobody could come close to them. No other military had that kind of ethics, honor, and valor. It just didn't happen. Didn't happen.
Right. They were incredibly honorable. And one thing I absolutely love about dealing with these old Germans, when you shake hands, that's a contract that can't be broken. And they never break their word.
Well, we should have ethics like that in this country.
Well, I don't know if anybody does anymore.
Well, I do, but that's
did in World War II, I think. But you know, we find that after the war, the winning side writes ex post facto laws that say, okay, it's illegal to have done this 5 years ago.
Yeah.
You guys did that 5 years ago, so now you're a war criminal.
Yeah.
And all the war criminals were on the losing side. All the war heroes were on the winning side. And Germany, you know, contrary to popular belief, did not start World War II. And, you know, when my daughter, who just recently got her bachelor's degree with many great honors, God bless her, tough kid.
That's wonderful.
When she was in, she's going on for her doctorate in psychology to work with families of soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
When she was in fifth grade, the history teacher started out with the same old tired crap that Germany or Hitler started World War II because he wanted to kill all the Jews and be king of the world.
Yeah, of course.
And my daughter stood up and said, "My daddy's a world-renowned historian," and he says, "That just isn't true." So the poor teacher, you know, my daughter was a straight-A student, and I was on the board of that school, so he just changed the subject. But unfortunately, they're still teaching this garbage today.
You bet.
Germany did not start the war.
No, Germany did not bomb England first either. It was a retaliatory strike after Berlin was bombed.
Right.
All lies. And in the entire war, the total number of German dead from bombing missions is unknown. It could be 2 million. We don't know. Nobody really knows.
Entire cities were wiped out.
Wiped out, and they weren't military targets. And the bomber Harris
like
and
Grayson.
Churchill, they knew. They knew Schweinfurt. And yet, in all the bombing missions run over Great Britain, the total number of dead is about 45,000. Now, we lament all deaths.
Yep.
But let's compare 45,000 to 2 to 3 million. We don't even know how many were incinerated in those horrible bombing raids.
Yeah, the fire bombings.
Dresden's probably 400,000 to 600,000 alone.
Yeah, and like I say, who really started World War II? In my opinion, and in the opinion of a lot of scholars, it was Poland. And why? Well, because up until 1918, there was no such place as Poland. It had been partitioned out, like in the 15th, 16th century, something like that, through other wars.
Correct.
When World War I ended, the victorious Allies got the map out and drew, okay, here's Poland. Well, yeah, but that had been Pomerania, that had been East Prussia, and there were German families living there for generation after generation. They had businesses, they had farms, and all of a sudden, they were a minority in another country that used to be theirs. And in the last 2 weeks of August 1939, about 450,000 Volksdeutsche, ethnic Germans, were forcibly shoved out of Poland, out of their farms, out of their businesses. They left everything except maybe they had a suitcase. And then, in those same last 2 weeks, about 49,000 Volksdeutsche were killed, massacred by the Polish authorities and the Polish civilians, many of them with their hands tied behind their back. They were beaten to death. So Hitler had to send in the troops.
No choice.
To protect his own people.
Absolutely. The pressure was overwhelming. I think most everyone listening would have done the same thing.
Yeah. And then, of course, they came out with the idea that Hitler was going to invade the United States. With what? He had no transport ships. He had no long-range planes.
Mm-hmm.
He saw it as he made over 20 peace proposals to England, and Churchill just shot all those peace proposals down. And
That's why Sea Lion wasn't pulled off.
That's correct. And that's why he stopped his armored divisions 15 kilometers short of Dunkirk.
Yeah.
And the last peace proposal was Rudolf Hess. Was not a lunatic who was out joyriding in a plane. He was sent over to England. He was supposed to parachute out onto the estate of the Duke of some such thing or another, who was cousin of the king, because Churchill kept short-stopping all these peace proposals.
Right.
He needed the war. And so, unfortunately for Hest, the Brits, they had a great intelligence group, and they knew he was coming. So they waited till he came down and grabbed him right away and stuck him into solitary. He couldn't talk to anybody forever. And a couple of years ago, I think I mentioned this on your show, one of our members, Charles Higham, who is mm-hmm. a world-renowned researcher and historian, he was digging into that,
mm-hmm.
and when I talked to him last, he said he was almost done with the book to prove that the crown, the British crown,
mm-hmm.
had really dirty hands, and next thing you know, one morning he woke up dead.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened to his manuscript? Who knows? Mm-hmm. It's gone.
Mm-hmm.
Funny how them things happen, eh?
Yeah, too many times.
But here we have Germany with two allies. One, Italy, who has never had an army.
They still don't.
Right. The Romans, they were not Italians. They were great, but the Italians never had a military worth beans. And the other one, the Japanese, who had a great military, but the Germans and Japanese didn't cooperate, didn't communicate, didn't trust each other. So basically Germany was on their own. Yet on the Allied side, there were, I think, 93 countries. But with the manufacturing might of the United States and with the Soviets being able to just pour in hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions of men into human wave onslaughts, how are you going to survive against that?
Correct.
And they didn't.
Yeah.
And as it turned out, the German economy was thriving before World War II. Hitler brought the country out of the depression faster than any other country. The big companies all loved it. Henry Ford sent $50,000 to Hitler every year on his birthday. Ford was making cars and trucks for the German military. General Motors, through their Adam Opel plant, was making tanks and armored cars for the Wehrmacht. The two major optic companies in the world split up the market division. Carl Zeiss supplied the Axis, and Bausch & Lomb supplied the Allies. The Seven Sisters, Standard Oil, Texaco, Humble Oil, etc., they sold fuel to everybody. So, yeah, and as a matter of fact, when the Germans were bombing England, they got their fuel from Standard Oil. When the RAF went up to fight, they got their fuel from Standard Oil. When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, they got their fuel from Standard Oil. So, I guess if you're selling to both sides, you're on the winning side, whether you like it or not.
Always the way it is. Big business, big bankers. They finance these things, and we pay the price.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, you can see a great parallel between Robin Hood and Sir Guy of Gisborne and Sheriff of Nottingham.
Mm-hmm.
Basically the same thing today, only they don't have the same titles.
Yeah.
And you think you're electing them. I'm not sure you are.
No.
I haven't met anybody yet who said they voted for Obama second time around. I've only met one or two people who admit they voted for him the first time around, yet he won. Pretty big.
Yeah. 75% of those who said they did vote for him second time around have said that they wish they hadn't. Too late.
Yeah.
Too late.
I wish they hadn't also. If you look at that sailboat that I had there, I still had that until Obama came into power, and then I couldn't afford to pay for the dock fee, so away went my sailboat, and it breaks my heart because my son helped me build it, and as you know, he was killed in 1984 when he was 20 years old, and every time I think about that boat, I see images of my son working on it, too.
And where is the boat now, Harry, do you know?
I have no idea. I have no idea. I'm planning to run up to the marina within the next week or so, where I had last seen it. I hadn't been up there for about 3 years. So
it's traceable. It had a hull number and all that.
Yeah, but we'll find out. So yeah. I have to go up there on some business for my friend Willis Carto.
Yeah,
who
sure.
Runs the American Free Press and the mm-hmm. Barnes Review. He's got some things he wants me to look into up in that area.
Good. Well, I hope someday you get it back if you want.
Yeah, I figured that. I had always figured that when the you know what hits the fan here.
Yeah, it's going to.
And the government collapses, I could take my family and sail off to Argentina because I can speak German well enough to get along in Argentina.
Sure. Yeah, and that boat could make the trip.
Oh, yeah. That boat, I knew the guy who owned the company that made it.
Uh-huh.
And when I was down in the Keys, just before I was ready to leave the Keys to go over to the Bahamas, he had a house down there, and he came and he took me and my girls out to dinner. And we were talking about where I was going in the Bahamas and everything, which is beautiful sailing. And I said, one day I want to sail around the world in... You know, with my boat. And he looked incredulous. He says, "In that?" I said, "What do you mean? You built it?" He says, "I wouldn't sail around the world in that."
How funny. Probably built it better than he built it. That's the funny part.
Yeah. I stiffened it and strengthened it and all
that.
Yeah,
I bet you did. Yeah.
But I think every young sailor wants to sail around the world. And then, you know, I got into the Bahamas and it was so beautiful there. There's no stress, no strain. The water's crystal clear.
So you've made it. Why go anywhere else?
Right. 85 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was a nice life. I was writing columns for the bowling magazines back in those days. They paid me a whopping $100 a month.
Well, times change.
Yeah.
All right,
yeah,
hold on.
Maybe they pay $200.
Yeah, at least. Maybe $210. Back in a minute with Harry. Hold on. Okay, let's go back to our pictures with Harry. And we're down just past the late afternoon picture of the sailboat with a little dinghy trailing along behind it.
Yeah, that that was taken by another boat. Nice people. You bump into people all along, and this one was named Alleluia. And so I got to talking to the guy in port in Nassau, the owner of that boat, the skipper. And I asked if he was a retired minister or something. He said, no, the Lord just got us this far. And I said, okay, what kind of weaponry are you carrying? Oh, nothing, he said. Well, God will protect us. I said, yeah, well, you're going into an area with a lot of pirates. So he asked what I carried, and I told him I had a I had an M16 with 200 rounds of armor piercing. I had a 44 Magnum, a 22 Derringer, a 38 I carried behind my back, and half a case of grenades. Oh, he says, can I sail along with you? Yes, sure. He was never any farther than that picture away from us down into the Exumas because people had been getting killed down there. Anyhow, after I returned back to the real world, I started researching, and that's what got me going on the U-boat thing. And then on the history, and Shark Hunters is the number one source of history, public history on the U-boat anywhere in the world. There are some Johnny-come-lately internet websites, which they never met any U-boaters. They don't have any real history. They have forums where anybody, Jeff Renz, can come and post that you heard there's a German U-boat sunk in Lake Titicaca, and you'd have 20 people coming on with threads. Oh, yeah, I heard about that, and you know, just total baloney. So now we've gotten into Hitler's escape because one of our members was a Spanish guy who was an agent working for the German Sicherheitsdienst. And he told us this story way back in 1986, I think it was 87. And some of his letters are reproduced in the book. And he sent me a 114-page long typewritten single-spaced letter on his time with the German secret security force and how he saw Hitler forcibly drugged under orders of Martin Bormann and removed from the bunker. Same with Eva Braun, because Bormann at that time was running the Reich from behind Hitler, and he needed Hitler to keep a figurehead. So, and we checked him out with various American spies and a couple of German spies. He was who he said he was. And then we found out about Heinrich Garbers getting people in and out of these Argentine ports. And about 10 years ago, we really started getting into it heavily. And in 2008, I went to Argentina, 2009, 2010, and again just this past January. It's a beautiful country. I really like Argentina. Buenos Aires is called the Paris of the South. And right now their economy is pretty much in free fall, so your Yankee dollar is pretty strong.
Yes.
And I saw something on the news where the Supreme Court has decided that Argentina still is on the hook for the $75 billion they allegedly owe to a Wall Street firm, and they have to pay it. So that's going to knock
their... the fix is in all over the world. It's all central banking and international banksterism, gangsterism.
And I'm still wondering, how does the United States Supreme Court have any jurisdiction over Argentina? That's the same
question.
Yeah, why does the United States have to run on into Iraq, Iran, and be the world's peacekeepers? You know, that's not our job. My thought, my two favorite words, carpet bombing. I was in the Air Force, and just carpet bomb the Middle East, kill them all, let God sort them out. Boy, that'll get you some hate mail, won't it, Jeff?
It probably won't, because a lot of Americans are really sick of all the chicanery and lies and death and slaughtering and suffering and massacring. Really, these people are completely bereft of any kind of central identity anymore. They're fragmented. Their religious fervor is enough to, it's so easy to take advantage of them.
Yeah.
And it's a mess. And it's not going to get any better. It's not supposed to get any better. This is the game. This is what the Israelis want.
Whoever wants it, it's going downhill, and it's unfortunate because, I grew up in a different America. I was a teenager in the 50s, and it was exactly like you see on Happy Days.
Or the movie American Graffiti, which is a wonderful film.
Yep.
It really is.
That's the way it was being a teenager in the 50s.
Yeah.
You know, my folks had a car. Well, mom and dad were both working, so we actually had two cars. Boy, that was big time back in the 50s, two cars.
Right. Yeah.
But Dad worked at the post office. My mom worked in a factory. But me and my buddies could pool our money and get a dollar together and just about fill the tank with gas and drive around all night chasing girls. Now, I just filled up my Suburban the other day. It cost, well, the pump shut off at $100.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you mean.
And I used to work for a petrochemical company during the so-called Arab oil embargo of the 1970s, and I know for a fact that that was all baloney, not theory. I was in charge of inventory control for that company, and our boss said that the Arabs have shut off the feedstocks, and I'm thinking, oh, good, I don't have to work so hard. Well, baloney. We never lost 1 pound of feedstock. We just raised our prices by 500%. And that was the beginning of this lunacy.
Mm-hmm.
So anyhow, back
I remember seeing pictures. We have a break coming up here, last one. I remember seeing pictures of gas station pumps with 9.9 cents a gallon, and then Supreme would be 11.9 or something.
Well, yeah, during the gas wars back in the 50s. Usually, though, it was like 20.9 cents a gallon.
Correct.
And on Tuesdays, you got double green stamps, and you got a towel or a glass, a drinking glass with a fill-up.
It had to be fun days.
It was a great time.
Yeah. Best decade of this country's history, many say.
I agree with it. Like I say, I was a teenager in the 50s. It was great. There was no drugs.
No.
And it was just a great time.
Yeah. Well, you're very lucky. Very lucky.
Yeah. These
kids now, just pity them. Back with Harry in just a sec. Hold on. Okay, back with Harry, and some more pictures. Here's some black and white photos, Harry, that clearly appear to be taken in Argentina. What year would these have been?
That would be in the late 30s, early 40s. You're talking about photo number 9 and 10?
Correct.
Yeah. There were meetings like this all over South America, not just Argentina. And they're still going on in some parts of South America today. We've got color pictures of those. But they're still having those meetings, those rallies. Every December, there's a march by several hundred people in black shirts, black pants, bloused black boots with... Every December now, on the anniversary of the day that the Graf Spee was destroyed and... Captain Langsdorff committed suicide. So they have a march down to the German cemetery and put flowers on his grave. So, and then photo 10, I never did find a date on that, but that's in La Prensa, which is the big newspaper in Argentina, Ein Führer. So, and if you translate the rest of it, actually I can't, that's the old German script. It's tough to translate. But then we move on to photo 11, and that's the place called Colonia Dignidad, Dignity Colony. This was founded by about 300 men of the Waffen-SS, which were the toughest fighters of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a closed community. You could not get in.
Gated community, one of the originals.
Gated, and guarded. You just couldn't get in, period. Photo 12, this is an all-girl band playing musical instruments, etc. Photo 13, you see how well-armed they were. They even had a tank. And then photo 14, they should have standardized their weaponry. It would have standardized their ammunition. I see an M1 carbine, U.S. manufactured, at the far end, and right next to it is it looks like a Heckler & Koch H&K 93. Then up at this end, it looks like a Czechoslovakian SKS. They had weapons of all sorts there. And allegedly, when Pinochet was ousting Allende in Chile, which is where Colonia Dignidad is, allegedly thousands of Allende supporters were dragged into Colonia Dignidad and never seen again.
I say
allegedly. Who knows? But now it's called Villa Bavaria, and it is open. Probably don't have as many weapons. Then the rest of the photos, 15 onward, this is the Grand Hotel of Paraguay. And we're just now finding that Borman was staying there also, as was Scorzani. And
is this still in Argentina, though, even though it's called?
No, this is
in Paraguay?
Paraguay now.
Okay.
Borman and Mengele and Rudel had stayed there. So we've just found a guy who worked there during those days, and we're going to be interviewing him when I get down there again. I'm going back in January.
That's an interesting photo. There's a 1957 Chevrolet four-door parked right smack in the middle. Yeah.
Yeah, this was taken afterwards, but you also see there's a BMW.
Yeah.
And there's a Volkswagen bus.
Sure do.
So we have a little German influence there, but.
Looks like a 56 Ford station wagon on the left.
Yeah.
55, 56.
Yeah, you'd have to get a better look at the taillights to tell whether it's 55 or 6. But, and these photos range anywhere from the 1930s up to the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
But remember, the dictator there in Paraguay was Alberto Stroessner. He was a German.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're finally finding information and proof that these guys were at this hotel as well. And assuming we get some help from our angels, I'm going back down there in January. And if any of the listeners want to donate tax deductible, because we have a 501c3, just send me an email at sharkhunters@earthlink.net and ask how to donate. It's tax deductible. We even have one of our members donated a car in January this year, which we sold and put the money into the exploration fund. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a lot of money. It was $1,800, but that helps with
sure.
the exploration,
sure.
And it's tax deductible. And we'll you know, somebody, if your listeners want a copy of the current issue of the magazine, just send me an email, sharkhunters@earthlink.net. Say you heard us on the Rents radio show and you want the current issue of the magazine.
It's really nice. I urge all of you to get it. No charge. Complimentary issue. It's first class. More pictures of the Grand Hotel de Paraguay. What city was this in then?
This is in the capital city of Asunción, Paraguay. And we're finding also in Uruguay very heavy German-leaning people in that area, too. There's a huge monument there in Uruguay to the Graf Spee, because the Graf Spee had been in the port of Montevideo, and they were going to try to make a dash across the river mouth to Buenos Aires, but the river there is like 50 miles wide, 50 miles or 50 kilometers, I can't remember which, but it's a long damn way.
Mm-hmm.
And Captain Langsdorff, was snookered, believing that the British had more than just the three cruisers. They had two light cruisers and one heavy cruiser, Ajax, Achilles, and Exeter, and he had pretty well banged them up in the first battle, but the Brits suckered him into believing that two battleships were out there, the Nelson and the Hood, and that Ark Royal was out there, too, with its airplane. So he didn't think he could make the dash across, so he blew up his ship there. And there's a huge monument to the Graf Spee on the Montevideo side, and I've learned from our number one agent, who we call Pizarro, that's a meeting place for people from the old Reich.
Mm-hmm.
And also people like Pizarro. So it's not ended. It's still going on.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure there are a lot of sons and grandsons who are carrying on the tradition as well. They've been probably given oral histories and other mementos and relics. It's all there.
Yeah. When we were there in 2010, we were at the town of General Belgrano, which is where all the enlisted men from the Graf Spee were sent to relocate after the Spee was destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And, we stayed at the Bavaria Hotel. We ate in the Munich restaurant. All this is in a little mountain town.
That's funny.
In Argentina. And the number one best-selling beer there was Warsteiner, which I like. It's a nice, crisp, light beer. And if you look at the website and go to previous tours, go to the 2010 tour to Argentina, you see some of the things we ate. It was bratwurst, sauerkraut, Schweinebraten, Jägerschnitzel in Argentina. And like I say, I can't speak Spanish, but I get along fine with my German. And buy stuff at a gift shop for my wife and kids.
Uh-huh.
I asked the guy there, "Sprechen Sie Deutsch?" No, he didn't speak German, but oh, momentito, por favor. And he's on the phone. About 3 minutes later, this good-looking young German kid, about 28, 29 years old, 6 foot tall, blue eyes, blonde hair, come in. He helped me get the gifts for my family. His grandfather had been a lieutenant general in the Panzer Corps, working with Kurt Meyer, who was the head of the Panzer Corps.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't dissolve. They just moved. And I am certainly, we've got the doors open because the people down there know that I'm just telling their history. I'm not a so-called Nazi hunter. There are secrets they've told me that I haven't told anybody, not even you. And they know their secrets are going to stay with me.
The way it should be.
Yeah.
Very it should be. Okay, the last picture there is a group of people around a table.
That's at the Grand Hotel also,
mm-hmm.
Paraguay.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what they're doing there, I just got that from another one of our agents.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the beauties of shark hunters, as opposed to other writers. They do whatever they do, research, maybe they travel, maybe they talk to somebody, maybe they do, maybe they don't.
Sure.
But we've got members, we got thousands of members in 76 countries, and some of them are current working spooks, excuse me, for different intel agencies. Some of them are retired spooks. Some of them are fanatic historians. Some of them are sons of the guys who fought in the war, in the U-boat. And so we have a network, not just Harry Cooper going to research. That Pizarro is saying, "Hey, this is what I found. Go check it out," or different agents are saying, "Hey, look, I found this. Here's the pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what these people say. Go talk to them." So I go and interview these people, and that's how we've got the number one top show.
Oh, there's no question, none. By the way, Adrian Salbucci knows Abel Basti.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah, Abel Basti is a member of Shark Hunter.
Yes. So,
and in my opinion, Abel Basti is the number one research on this history in South America.
Yeah, he's recognized as such by Adrian. Did I give you Adrian's phone number or just his email?
Just his email, and the rest you can send to me later.
Okay.
And this new book, this other so-called book, Gray Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler.
Yeah.
These people apparently posed Abel Basti real good.
Yeah.
And Abel suing them, but, he's in Argentina.
Yeah, it's hard.
Williams, the one they're suing, the one author, he's a Brit, but he lives in France. So, boy.
Yeah, it's a mess.
Yeah, it's a mess. And
theft is almost unpunishable anymore internationally. It's just
I'm afraid
ridiculous.
So. And now some Jewish guy named Noam something or another, he's coming out with a book on Hitler's escape.
Mm-hmm.
And Williams, who allegedly plagiarized a bunch of stuff from my book and from Abel Basti's book, he's crying that these people are plagiarizing from his book.
Jeez.
That he plagiarized from somebody else.
Wherever there's a buck to be made, these people show up. That's sad.
Yeah, I wish I made some money off of this, but it goes into shark hunters to help us keep going.
Well, you will. All right, my friend. Great to talk to you. Keep me posted. Anything I can do, let me know, Harry.
You
bet. My best to the family, please.
Good. Thank you so much. And God bless you guys for what you're doing.
Always. All right. You be well. Okay. Harry Cooper at sharkhunters.com. Back in a minute.